It is Thursday, September 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, at least one person is reported dead and more than 100 others are injured in a New Jersey train wreck. The Indian Army launches a strike against suspected militants in Pakistan.
They had gathered credible intelligence yesterday itself that told them that these terrorists, a group of, at launch pads and were waiting to cross into India, to infiltrate into India to launch attacks.
And country music remembers one of its pioneering women stars. It's all ahead. At least one person has been reported dead and more than 100 injured after a commuter train crashed into a busy rail station in Hoboken, New Jersey. The station is a crucial transfer station for thousands of people who commute daily between New Jersey and New York City. I spoke with VOA's Ramon Taylor, who's in Hoboken.
I'm actually about two blocks away from the scene of the crash at this point. This is as close as they've allowed reporters to be. We're all corralled here waiting for updates really on the latest of those injured, how many fatalities there are. A lot of unknowns at this point. We just know that the numbers are in the very high dozens of those that are injured and potentially more than one fatality.
Is it known at all what caused this?
No, there. At this point, we know that the train didn't stop and it was going at a very high speed. So whether this was accidental on the part of the engineer or whether some sort of accident happened either purposely, we don't know. The engineer, as we know, has been evacuated, headed toward the hospital. He's at the hospital right now, but we don't have any sort of answers on that, and investigators are trying to get to the bottom of that.
Now, I guess this happened during the commuter time this morning. I mean, Hoboken is a pretty bustling, popular suburb of New York City.
It really is. Hoboken, after Newark, is really a giant hub for the citizens of New Jersey, especially those that commute to New York City. 60,000 plus commuters travel both ways every day to the city. And this happened right at rush hour. So you can imagine just a high density time, 8:45 this morning, a train traveling from Spring Valley. And again, we heard that it didn't stop. We know that potentially if there are more than one fatality, it might be the case that it might be a mixture of those that were on the train when it happened and possibly inside the station as well, because we know that the train actually slammed past the ticket turnstiles and into the station, into cement beams, causing the roof to partially collapse. So we're worried not just about those that were on the train, but those that were in the station as well.
What kind of an impact has this had on, on commuting in the area?
It's a nightmare scenario for one. Every station around here is shut off. I personally, to try to get here from New York, had to travel on a ferry about 6 miles away and then take a taxi 2 miles away and walk. So those that are trying to get to work, police have told them to stay home if they're trying to get to this area. It's really become quite a mess. And as far as the station itself is concerned, where, again, up to 60,000 passengers travel daily, it's going to be quite some time before they're back on their feet.
That's VOA's Ramon Taylor reporting from Hoboken, New Jersey. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's the reaction to all this on social media?
Oh, there's a lot of reaction. Everything from hashtag Hoboken to New Jersey Transit, all those terms trending, not just in the U.S., but around the world as people look at this crash and wonder what happened. That's in the immediate aftermath when we have incidents like this. That's usually the first thing that people talk about on social media. What caused this? And especially in light of the attacks in Chelsea and in New York City and Elizabeth, New Jersey, those bombing attacks, people wondering, is this terrorism related? What exactly is going on? So a lot of those questions still yet to be answered and people searching for those answers on social media. We're also seeing a lot of the imagery from this crash. Passengers, nowadays everybody has a smartphone, so passengers on the train filming as they're getting off the train, people waiting for other trains, filming the immediate aftermath, taking photos. So when this happened, just moments afterwards, we saw on social media the first images that quickly spread. And we saw a lot of accounts of close calls, people saying, I was supposed to be on that train, but I missed it because I overslept and I missed it by only a few minutes. Otherwise, I could have been hurt or even killed. People in the station saying, I had just left the station when this happened. So we're seeing a lot of people react in that way. And then we're also seeing some acts of heroism and acts of kindness. The one tweet I saw was there's a local pizzeria that was a few blocks away, and they're bringing just stacks and stacks, look like a dozen pizzas in each of these two men that are holding them, dozen pizzas that each of them has. And they're bringing them to the first responders and the passengers who are stranded there and other folks just as an act of kindness. So we're seeing all of these different things play out on social media. But again, people hoping that the answers will be forthcoming. And when they are, we'll be sure to see those trending.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Some of the top stories trending. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the U.S. is on the verge of suspending talks with Russia over Syria. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas plans to travel to Jerusalem to attend the funeral of former Israeli President and Prime Minister Shimon Peres. Sudan is accused of using chemical weapons in Darfur. And U.S. presidential candidates Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are hitting the campaign trail. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study finds a huge region at the center of the Milky Way is devoid of young stars. A team of Japanese, South African, and Italian astronomers found that there are no Cepheid stars in an area that extends some 8,000 light years from our galaxy center. Cepheid stars are said to repeatedly pulsate in brightness and are quite young, between 10 and 300 million years old, in comparison to our 4.6 billion year old sun. Giuseppe Bono, one of the study's authors, said their research shows that there has been no significant star formation in this large patch of the Milky Way for over hundreds of millions of years. The researchers made their findings after analyzing observations made in the near-infrared light range, since looking for stars so deep in the galaxy can be quite difficult. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we remember country music star Gene Shepherd. India's army said Thursday that it had launched surgical strikes against suspected militants along the border with Pakistan. But Islamabad rejected the claim, calling it an incident of cross-border firing. I spoke with VOA's Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi and asked her about the evidence cited by India to justify the attacks.
What Lieutenant General Ranbir Singh, he's India's Director General of Military Operations, said at a news conference today was that they had gathered credible intelligence yesterday itself that told them that these terrorists, a group of, at launch pads and were waiting to cross into India, to infiltrate into India to launch attacks. That's all that we have from the army.
Now, this, of course, follows the attack on an Indian army base earlier this month in Kashmir. And at that time, Prime Minister Narendra Modi said that attack would not go unpunished.
Absolutely. You know, the Prime Minister has been under tremendous pressure, both from within his party and from the public, to retaliate and give Pakistan some kind of a tough response for what India says. India believes it's Pakistan-backed militants which mounted the attack, of course. So for the last 10 days, this attack took place on September 18th. He has been mulling what to do. Various options have been weighed. Initially, they were putting diplomatic pressure on Pakistan, and Mr. Modi had said he will diplomatically isolate Pakistan, which led most analysts to believe that India would not go in for any kind of a military option. So today's announcement was a bit of a surprise, but apparently the Prime Minister has gone further than any previous government ever has in India in letting the army apparently cross the border with Pakistan and conduct strikes there against alleged terror camp.
Well, now, meanwhile, Pakistan is very unhappy with this. It says that the notion of a surgical strike linked to alleged terrorist bases, it calls this an illusion.
Absolutely. There have been very, very strong reactions from there. They've called it a fabrication. They have said it will ratchet up tensions along the border. They say that it was actually unprovoked firing from the Indian side which started this incident. That it will escalate tensions between the two, you know, these two nuclear-armed countries is without doubt. Pakistan is obviously not going to like this incident, whatever caused it and whatever it was, because we have counterclaims from both sides. But what we will see, I think, is a little more volatility along the Kashmir border, which has always been so tense, you know.
I was just going to say that. I mean, Kashmir has always been such a controversy between the two countries, between India and Pakistan, because they both claim it.
Absolutely. I mean, it's been the trigger of two of their three wars. But, you know, since 2004, both sides had signed a ceasefire agreement along the line of control. That's actually the de facto border between the two countries. And it was calm for almost 8 or 9 years. We didn't see significant tensions. But over the last 3 or 4 years, I think because of what India says is increasing attempts at infiltration, and because what India says are attacks backed by Pakistan-based militants, the tensions have again risen between the two sides. We've seen more incidents of cross-border firing, and the attack on the army base was what many Indian analysts say, the kind of last resort and the last trigger which set off this latest round of tensions.
That's Anjana Pasricha reporting from New Delhi. Rising political resistance to trade agreements worries some key economic leaders who say expanding trade contributes to global growth and helps create jobs and cuts prices for goods. The comments come as both major party candidates in the U.S. presidential campaign have criticized a major Pacific trade deal, with Republican Donald Trump calling it a catastrophe. As VOA's Jim Randall reports, new data show trade growth is already faltering.
Hanjin, the huge Korean shipping company, bankrupted by slowing global trade. Many crews stranded at sea without money for docking fees until an emergency deal was worked out. Global trade is now set to grow just 1.7% this year, the slowest pace since the financial crisis, according to the World Trade Organization. Stalled trade agreements get some blame for slowing trade growth and the world economy, according to trade supporters. But Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump says flawed trade deals killed millions of jobs. He opposes the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP.
It will be a disaster, and you can't allow TPP to happen. It will be a catastrophe.
The head of the International Monetary Fund told a Chicago audience that trade can be a key driver of economic growth.
Restricting trade is a clear case of economic malpractice. Because rather than helping those sectors of the economy it means to protect, shutting off trade would deny families and workers important economic opportunities, wreak havoc on supply chains, and raise the cost for many basic goods.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says trade deals also help American diplomacy, influence, and security.
If we reject TPP, we take a giant step backward. We take a step away from this vital platform for cooperation. We take a step away from our leadership in the Asia Pacific. We take a step away from the protection of our interests and the promotion of universal values.
Kerry says a successful trade deal would help Americans shape events in the Pacific, home to a quarter of the world's population, and where he says much of the history of the 21st century will be written. Jim Randall, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. country music's trailblazing artists has died. Honky Tonk singer-songwriter Gene Shepherd passed away of complications related to Parkinson's and heart disease. She was 82 years old. We talk about her legacy with VOA One's Nikki Strong. Well, Nikki, before Loretta Lynn and Tammy Wynette, there was Gene Shepherd.
Yes, to use her words, when there was none of us, there was Gene. She was in the business when there were very few female role models and even fewer female solo country artists, especially successful ones. There was Kitty Wells, basically. And at the beginning of her career, when she met Hank Williams, for example, she told him she wanted to be a country music star. And he told her, oh, yeah, well, there isn't much room in this business for a country woman singer. And she said that really made her determined to do what she loved. And her determination paid off. She was the first female country artist to go on tour by herself.
Wow.
Now, this wasn't heard of, because during that time, when women performed on tour, they either performed with their husbands, or they performed with, like, a family band, or they performed with a band, but they were just called, like, the girl singers with a band. So she also sang music from a woman's perspective. So an example is The Root of All Evil is a Man. In which she warns women that men can be liars and cheaters and callous about breaking your heart. In her song, Second Fiddle to an Old Guitar, which is a really funny song, she sings about a man who loves his guitar so much that she just feels second rate. You know, she's tired of playing second fiddle to an old guitar. She's also been credited with releasing country music's first concept album called Songs from a Love Affair back in 1956, and she was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame in 2011. Many people felt that was way overdue when it finally came. And so she's had a considerable number of hits as well. And her success, of course, opened doors for Tammy Wynette, for Patsy Cline, and of course, later on, Loretta Lynn.
Well, Gene Shepherd became known as the Grand Lady of the Grand Ole Opry.
Yes, that too. She joined in 1955. She was the third woman to join after comedian Minnie Pearl and the first female country star, Kitty Wells. And I think it's important to note that both Kitty Wells and Gene Shepherd were very successful because of how powerful the Grand Ole Opry was. The Grand Ole Opry, for people who don't know, was a pioneering, longest-running live country music program that dates back to 1925. So even Jean was listening to the Grand Ole Opry before she even joined. She was listening to it as she was growing up. So any country artist who's deep into country knows about the Grand Ole Opry. They're very influential. They have grown to be an iconic country music institution and a curator and a gatekeeper of country music's legacy. So their influence really helped make her a star.
Well, now, Gene Shepherd was a staunch supporter of traditional country music as well.
Most definitely, especially as part of the Grand Ole Opry and a honky-tonk singer. For a while, it was hard for her. I mean, she had several hits, and then for a while, it was hard for her to land another hit because Nashville was pushing a more country pop sound. And in 1974, I think this is interesting, when pop artist Olivia Newton-John was named Female Vocalist of the Year by the Country Music Association, the Association of Country Entertainers was formed, and Gene Shepherd served as its president. And she was known to say something like, I'm sure Olivia Newton-John was a great lady, but she didn't sing country music. She also went in on Blake Shelton, and I think this is funny too. He made a derogatory comment about country music traditionalists. And she said, and this is a quote, we've got a young man in country music who has made some pretty dumb statements lately. What did he say? That traditional country music is for old farts and jack-you-know-whats? Well, I guess that makes me an old fart. I love country music. I won't tell you what his name is, but his initials is BS, and he's full of it. She was great. I think that really captures her spirit.
Yeah. Well, you can find out more about Gene Shepherd and hear both traditional and contemporary country music on Country Hits with Nikki Strong. You can also share your thoughts on Gene Shepherd on Twitter and Facebook at VOA One The Hits. Thanks very much, Nikki.
You're welcome.
Once we were so happy, you were my very own. But then you bought that guitar and you ruined our happy home. You told me that you're gonna pick, you're gonna be a star. I'm tired of playing second fiddle to an old guitar. You gaze at that guitar on your knee in a way that you never look at me. This love affair of yours has gone too far, and I'm tired of playing second fiddle to an old guitar.
That That is the music of the late country music star Gene Shepherd. Well, we've been hearing a lot about politics recently, and this is one of the latest stories. This gathered quite a bit of attention here in the U.S. Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson showed his lack of knowledge about world affairs for a second time when he failed to come up with the name of a current leader of a foreign country. In a town hall-style televised interview on Wednesday night, MSNBC host Chris Matthews asked the presidential hopeful to name his favorite foreign leader. Johnson sat speechless before his running mate, former Massachusetts Governor William Weld, said his favorite was Shimon Peres, who died on Wednesday. Matthews went back to Johnson and prodded him to name a living leader from any country. "You got to do this," Matthews said to him. "Anywhere, any continent." And Johnson said, "Well, I guess I'm having an Aleppo moment." That he said that in reference to an interview earlier in September when he asked, "What is Aleppo?" in response to a question about the Syrian city that has been a flashpoint in the more than five-year-old civil war. Well, that certainly, as I said, gathered quite a bit of a notice recently. Well, looking at the medical front, not everyone who's infected with HIV goes on to develop AIDS. A tiny fraction of HIV-positive adults holds the line against AIDS by mounting a very strong immune response. But research has found that such an approach often contributes to the development of other illnesses such as heart disease and cancers. And this was found out by scientists at Oxford University. Well, that's our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is providing more than $181 million in additional humanitarian assistance for the Iraqi people to address critical humanitarian needs, including those expected to occur with Iraq's planned military offensive to liberate Mosul from Daesh occupation. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced this new funding September 14th, bringing U.S. humanitarian assistance for Iraqis to nearly $1.1 billion since fiscal year 2014. The United States remains committed to supporting the government of Iraq, including the Kurdistan Regional Government, in their response to the humanitarian crisis, as well as supporting the Iraqi people during their time of need. The United Nations anticipates the upcoming offensive could result in the displacement of more than 1 million people from Mosul and surrounding areas, exacerbating an already dire crisis that has left an estimated 10 million people, nearly a third of the country's population, in need of humanitarian assistance, and more than 3.3 million Iraqis displaced inside their own country as a consequence of Daesh's brutality. With this additional funding to international and non-governmental humanitarian organizations, the U.S. government reaffirms its commitment to support Iraq and provide assistance to displaced and conflict-affected Iraqis. The new funding enables the prepositioning of emergency food assistance and basic relief items to displaced Iraqis in preparation for the Mosul campaign. This money funds essential water, sanitation, and hygiene services that will provide displaced Iraqis with safe drinking water, clean latrines, and shower facilities. In addition to the funding to support Mosul preparedness, U.S. funding will support UNHCR and other agencies' efforts to provide assistance to the estimated 230,000 Iraqi refugees in Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, and Turkey, including shelter, cash assistance, protection, and other forms of assistance. It will also support ongoing operations in Iraq to provide for the humanitarian needs of those already displaced by the conflict with Daesh, including livelihood support and social cohesion efforts, education, cash assistance, and protection monitoring services. The U.S. encourages other donors to follow our recent announcements with their own commitments to provide timely additional assistance for Iraqis, including for the forthcoming needs for Mosul, as well as for other global crises.
That was an editorial reflecting